From Michigan Radio, you are listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Michigan's Treasury Department pushed so hard to get Flint into the new Water Authority and then failed the people of Flint.
Treasury was in the position to say, let's make the best decision for the entire region, and they failed to do that as well.
2 years after the launch of Healthy Michigan brought some 600,000 people into Medicaid, what has that meant to healthcare in Michigan?
That amount of people that enrolled was something we were projecting wouldn't happen for 5 years.
An early toll from prescription drug abuse, looking back 54 years to the death of Marilyn Monroe.
Her doctor should have known better than to give her all of these medications at the same time, given her state of mind and the suicidal thoughts.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You may have heard of urban farmers, but how about urban equestrians? We'll learn more on the next idea later this hour. And we'll check in on just how well Michigan's doing with the Affordable Care Act. And we'll take another look at the death of Marilyn Monroe through the lens of America's ongoing opioid epidemic. But first, with the unfolding of the Flint water crisis came mountains of blame heaped on the State Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Health and Human Services. But Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer says there's another state agency that needs to share in the blame, the Treasury Department. Peter Hammer is the director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at the Wayne State Law School. He's with us now. Peter, as you dug through the state and city records and documents and emails, what did you find? In what ways do you believe the Treasury Department is complicit in the Flint crisis?
Yeah, there's so much more that needs to be told. And I've always been suspicious of what was not in the news yet. If you look at all the reporting, it has all the facts but none of the motive. And as a lawyer and economist, which I start doing is just follow the money. So the first thing to do is say, well, how did Flint get into trouble? What did the emergency manager do? What was the decision to approve the KWA? Could Flint afford such an expensive new program? And what money was invested to get the water treatment plant up and running? And when you start asking those questions, a lot of fingers get pointed towards the Treasury Department and the emergency managers.
And that would be, at that time, Treasurer Andy Dillon. And he's the one who signed off on having Flint be a part of the Karenandi Water Authority, the KWA. Did you find any evidence that he gave any thought to the fact that Flint was flat broke?
Yeah, this is the big contradiction that you would think as you're approving a decision, you would approve not only does this make sense, but can I pay for it? And when you actually look back at the documents, very little attention was given to the question of how Flint would actually pay for either the $85 million necessary to construct its share of the pipeline, or, as estimated in 2011, the $60 to $69 million it would be necessary to get upgrades to its water treatment plant to process raw water. And it was only after they approved the program they started to ask the question how they're going to pay for it. And there was a lot of political energy put into trying to get the money raised for the pipeline. And the big contrast, and this is where I think the notion of structural racism and strategic racism come in, almost no effort was made by Treasury or the emergency managers or others to actually get external financing for the water treatment plant. And we all know what happened when they switched to the Flint River without the water treatment plant up and running in an appropriate way.
You found very clearly that Treasury turned itself inside out and even pushed through an environmental consent order that bent the rules, right, so that the cost of building the KWA would not count against Flint's debt limit?
Yeah. No, this is, again, they're in emergency management because they don't have money. And now we're approving these multi-million-dollar projects, and when they come to the realization they can't pay for it under state law because of limits on how much bond debt can be taken, you got to tell the political story. It's the bond lawyers, really, that start pushing it for KWA, and they've got allies at Treasury that are pressuring the Department of Environmental Quality. And what they end up doing is manufacturing an administrative consent order out of a violation in a lime sludge lagoon at the water treatment plant, and then define the scope of purpose for the administrative consent order to permit them to raise the $85 million to pay for the KWA construction that had nothing to do with the underlying violation. And what's really tragic is that they raised no money in that process to pay for the water treatment plant. Right? So I think there's sort of the story of the commission of what they actually did, which is very suspicious, and the story of omission of who they neglected and what lives did not matter in the story.
You use that term structural racism. What do you mean by that? What did that look like?
Yeah, well, two quick notions, structural racism and strategic racism. Structural racism really is what explains how Flint got into financial trouble in the beginning. And that's the story of housing discrimination and racially restrictive covenants and white flight and the collapse of the inner cities at the time that the suburbs are prospering. And so what you have in Genesee County really is prosperous white suburbs surrounding a shrinking inner city that is largely African-American. That's the structural racism that is the root cause of the municipal distress for Flint in the beginning. Strategic racism is when people come in and manipulate the effects of intentional discrimination or structural racism for their own private gain. In the report, I characterize what was taking place for the KWA as a really important example of strategic racism. They may not have intended it with racial intent, but they're exploiting the vulnerability that's created by the structural racism for the private gain of the people who wanted to push the KWA agenda.
Peter, I was struck by the fact that you found that Andy Dillon, the then treasurer, actually rejected a report that he commissioned that found it would cost more to have Flint go with KWA than to stay with Detroit Water. He rejected that?
Yeah, and you know, sort of when you start looking at the documents and putting a timetable together, a lot of shocking things come out. Treasury commissioned a report that they ultimately rejected. And there's a moving target, so I don't want to undo the fact that there is complexity in this and there's an evolving story. But at the end of the day, what I indict them on is the failure to exercise independent economic judgment. The most favorable thing that you can say is that the case had not been made on either way, and they pushed it through on political ends. More importantly, the only benefit of emergency management, and this is the responsibility of Treasury, is actually to try to rationalize and limit interregional competition. So at the time they approved the KWA, which is going to have tremendously negative effects on the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, Treasury was in the position to say, let's make the best decision for the entire region, and they failed to do that as well. So I think you can point to numerous decisions where Treasury did not come to the standard that you would expect, particularly when they're overseeing the emergency manager who has the absolute obligation to see that the needs of Flint are taken care of, and Treasury at best was asleep at the switch and at worst was complicit in the politics that was going on to push a KWA agenda that was not in the best interest of the residents of Flint.
We're talking with Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer. And Peter, from the emails and the records that you studied, could you figure out why Treasury seemed so hell-bent on making Carinanti happen? I mean, they turned things upside down and inside out. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, I think, again, there's a little more consternation in the beginning. The Department of Environmental Quality was in cahoots early on, and there's an important memo that was written in January of 2012 that hasn't gotten the attention it deserves by a KWA engineer named John C. O'Malley, who basically, and this is writing to Leanne Schachter-Smith, who was just recently indicted on criminal charges, reproducing conversations that he had with DEQ, saying that the emergency managers for the pipeline, the former mayors for the pipeline, and that they've devised a clever strategy to let the city council vote on it as an insurance policy in case the emergency manager law is invalidated. So the political cake was baked early on, and Treasury was trying to manage the politics of it and ultimately didn't do its job. Once the decision was made, Treasury goes in to try to make sure it can be financed, right? And so it comes back at the game and is pushing the political agenda and carrying the water forward, so to say, to make sure construction can take place. But again, if you focus on the fact that they didn't do anything on the water treatment plant, I think you have that, again, stark contrast that says who has lives that matter and who don't. And the neglect of the water treatment plant is an important part of the story that needs to be raised up.
And to your point about that email from John O'Malley to Leanne Schachter-Smith, and we hear Governor Snyder and other state officials all through this have pointed often to that vote by Flint City Council in 2013 saying, see, city officials wanted this. But you're saying that email shows that it was basically a deliberate strategy to make this thing stick no matter what happened with the EM law.
Yeah, it's being too clever by a half. And it's the notion that they were saying they want to get the KWA, they want to make sure they have the legal protection, and some clever lawyer saying, well, if you let city council do it, even under emergency management, then it can't be challenged, arguably. But I would encourage people to go and look at the actual YouTube video of the city council meeting. It's very clear that the city council wasn't provided with all the background information. They weren't given a copy of the report the Treasury was commissioned that was highly critical of the KWA. So it's a very confused meeting, and they're sitting there asking, well, why are we making this decision? You're not letting us do anything else, and yet you want us to make this one decision. And when you look at the underlying emails at the time, it's very clear that that was a charade. There is no democratic legitimacy to that vote at all, and it was really an effort to get an insurance policy for the KWA pipeline.
As you did your research, Peter, did you get a chance to speak with Andy Dillon?
I did not. What I was doing was a review of all the emails that had been released and provided.
Now that you've pored through all these documents and emails, what would you like to ask him?
I think one question is, does he regret it? You know, I think what a lot of people were doing was playing politics as usual without understanding the huge stakes that ultimately were involved. And secondly, I would ask him, would he do anything differently? Mm-hmm. And then I think he could go as a reporter, as a lawyer, down a whole line of things about particular decisions he made that were questionable. And in particular, the fact that he didn't try to look at rationalizing what was best for the entire region. And he let politics and Flint ultimately come down and create greater interregional rivalry over what should be a public good and a public utility than has any economic justification.
And then just kind of going back to that earlier question I had is, you read all of these documents and emails. Did you get any glimmering of answer to the really deep question, why was the KWA so important to these people?
No, and I think that's a question that really needs further reporting. It's very clear that you can see the force field that was created that moved political actors, and I think there needs to be more pushing. I mean, what I would do if I were a reporter and not a law professor would be starting to really look at down the financial campaign and contributions, right? So who was giving money to the Genesee Drain Commissioner? How was the ability to aggregate that and flow financial campaign contributions to others being used? So there's a whole side of the sort of political decision-making and who has influence and who does not that is still not told. It's very clear that the power was exercised, but the whole question of why and how they garnered so much influence still is an untold story.
Peter J. Hammer, director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights at the Wayne State University Law School. It was great to talk with you, Peter. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us.
It's my pleasure.
The Michigan Department of Treasury gave us a statement and said a spokesperson might be available to join us later in the week. Here is the statement. I quote, "While we disagree with many of the facts and conclusions reached in Professor Hammer's paper, our focus will remain on moving forward with the city, county, and state to do all we can to improve the lives of the residents of Flint." And we also received an email response from former State Treasurer Andy Dillon, which reads in part, and again I quote, "The conclusion that Flint had financial risk for the KWA project is not accurate. Flint's only obligation was to purchase water from the KWA when construction was completed for the price agreed upon. This was noted in the conditional letter of approval, which I don't see referenced anywhere in the professor's report. His claim that Flint was on the hook for $85 million of the $285 million for KWA is not accurate. Where is the document showing that?" The statement is too long for us to read in full on air, but you will find Andy Dillon's entire response at Stateside's page at michiganradio.org. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The headlines were huge and screaming on April 21st this year. Prince found dead in an elevator in his home. The cause of death, an opioid overdose. Or 2009, June 25th, more screaming headlines. Michael Jackson, dead from an overuse of propofol, a prescription drug to help him sleep, and anti-anxiety drugs. And the headlines from 54 years ago told the same tragic story. Film star Marilyn Monroe found dead in her Hollywood home. The cause? Overdose of prescription drugs. Marilyn Monroe's funeral was this day, August 8th, 1962. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is back here again. Howard, this was a story as big as it was tragic, wasn't it?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, Marilyn Monroe was, well, Marilyn Monroe. She was probably the biggest star or superstar in Hollywood at that time.
And kind of remind us again, and you stop and you go, she was 36 when she died, so she
only
had a
36.
Short, bright career.
Right.
That was kind of not doing well at the time that she died.
Yeah, Marilyn's personal problems just kept catching up with her. And she was probably always a very troubled individual, and there was a lot of mental illness that ran in her family. Her mother was bipolar and depressed. Marilyn was probably an abused child. And there were all these other things that happened to her as a starlet and star in Hollywood. It was not such a friendly place, let's put it mildly. And by the end of her career, when she was 36, she had just been fired from a movie from her longtime studio, 20th Century Fox. The film was called Something's Gotta Give. How's that for
terrible irony, huh?
Yeah. And it was a remake of a very famous movie, My Favorite Wife, a 1940 film. But she was fired and she was absent a lot, either very late getting to the set or absent from the set, most likely hungover from too much alcohol and too much drugs. She preferred barbiturates, a sleeping pill, sedatives, things like that. And the studio said, well, you know, you were well enough to sing Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
That famous thing.
In Madison Square Garden for John F. Kennedy. So there was all this stuff going on in her life just shortly before she died.
And what did they find? I know a housekeeper, was it, who tried to get in and realized that she wasn't answering?
Yeah, well, the last full day of her life was August 4th, 1962, and she was quite upset and depressed, and her psychoanalyst was concerned about her, and he actually said, I'm going home for the night. And he said to her housekeeper, could you please keep a watch on her? Marilyn was said to have gone to bed to retire to her bedroom at 8 p.m. For some reason, she was allowed to lock the door and not watched, despite the fact that she had been talking about suicide. And it wasn't until about 3:30 in the morning that her assistant found that the light was still on, knocked on the door. There was no answer. She went outside to view Marilyn through the French windows of her bedroom and saw that Marilyn looked quite odd, quite peculiar, and all she was doing was lying there hanging on to a phone. The receiver was off the hook and she was hanging on to it. The housekeeper then called her psychoanalyst, who came immediately. They broke in, and of course, by 3:50 a.m., Marilyn was declared dead.
And you spell out in your essay the unbelievable array of things found at her bedside table. Take it away.
Oh, boy, she had a regular pharmacy right next to her bedside table. There were all sorts of barbiturates, amphetamines, opiates, opioids, alcohol. She liked champagne, but she also drank a lot of sherry and alcohol. Chloral hydrate, which used to be called in the old detective stories, you know, Mickey Finns or sleeping drops.
We still
use it as pediatricians to sedate children. It's a very powerful sedative. And the problem is that when you're taking those three things, a barbiturate, chloral hydrate, and alcohol, the medical term is they potentiate each other. They make each other more powerful. So that's a problem in and of itself. And then the more powerful sedatives are, you tend to forget what you took.
Yes.
And if you're still awake, you say, I want to take some more.
I need to sleep.
Yeah. And that's probably what happened. Mm-hmm. We don't know, but that's probably what happened.
All gotten by prescription.
Mm-hmm.
Were they from different doctors, the same doctor? Was she good at playing pharma and medical roulette, as we heard, for example, Michael Jackson was?
She didn't have as many doctors as some of these more recent cases, but she was good at manipulating her doctors to prescribe whatever she wanted. It was not at this late date of the opiate epidemic where we should know better. But you know what? Her doctor should have known better than to give her all of these medications at the same time, given her state of mind and the suicidal thoughts she was having.
Through the years, there's certainly been a pretty healthy crop of conspiracy theories about her death, including a big one centering on her, I'm going to use air quotes here, involvement with both President John Kennedy and his brother Bobby, supposedly. What do you feel, medically speaking, is the best and most believable explanation?
Well, I'm going to get some angry mail on this one, but most likely she accidentally killed herself. Let's think that she didn't really mean to, but it's hard to say. But it seems that she accidentally overdosed. But the conspiracy theories are just incredible. Well, one thing that is problematic, when they did an autopsy on her, they did not find the Nebutol capsules. That was the barbiturate she took. And you should have seen the gelatin capsules.
Like in her gut.
In her gut. They didn't see those. And then there was theories, well, maybe somebody injected her, but they could find no needle tracks on her arms or legs or the obvious places. And then somebody said, well, maybe they gave her an enema containing barbiturates, that they got her drunk or knocked out or what have you and then did it. And then, of course, there are all these – was it the Mafia? Was it the Kennedys? You know, Peter Lawford, near the end of his life, who was a Kennedy brother-in-law until he wasn't, and then he was drummed out of the Corps. And there's reasons why he might have
– axe to grind.
An axe to grind. Of course, Peter Lawford was also a well-known alcoholic, a drug addict, and had chronic liver disease. So that, too, could have affected his mind. But he famously – or infamously said, you know, Bobby was just crazy about getting her and I should have never have let him get involved. And I don't know what that means, but of course the conspiracy theorists absolutely love comments
bubbling
like that.
Away. But when you stop and you draw the line from Marilyn Monroe's death and thinking of her funeral 54 years ago today to what we've seen with so many, and also, you know, Prince, I started with that. It has much the same sense to find him dead in the elevator
yes.
at Paisley Park and then realize that he had been juggling opioids for back pain.
Right.
We have this conversation about these prescription drugs and prescription painkillers, and it
right.
can start off as innocently as I had my wisdom teeth out and I got Vicodin from the dentist.
Yes. Yes.
And then off
they are typically prescribed for good reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you cross that borderline into bad reasons, and that's where, you know, good doctoring really makes a difference. And how much we prescribe and how much we refill is only been recently looked at. And you're right, the opioid-opiate epidemic, the overdose epidemic, which is quite striking. America, United States of America is about 5% of the world's population, and yet it consumes more than 75% of all prescription opiates, opioids, things like that. So there's something going on here. There's a disconnect, and it remains a problem. And it's not just movie stars who can manipulate their physicians to get more medications. Addicts are fairly crafty people. And so we have to be extremely careful about using these medications for good, but being very careful about their huge, huge addictive potential and the way they ruin lives.
A sad and a cautionary tale. Dr. Howard Markel, the University of Michigan Medical School, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
A new kind of horsepower for Detroit and its kids. Not cars, but horses. That's the dream of our latest contributor to The Next Idea. David Silver is a former Detroit elementary school teacher. He's the founder of Detroit Horsepower. The goal of this group, to teach urban kids to care for and ride horses, and that in turn teaches them critical skills they need to succeed. David Silver, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me.
You grew up in Westchester County, New York, and through your teens became quite a competitive rider. Give us some examples of the kind of life lessons that you now realize you learned by being so closely involved with horses and working with them.
Horses develop a tremendous amount of confidence, you know, when you're up there controlling a 1,000-pound animal that has a mind of its own. You really have to believe in yourself, can't second guess your abilities, rely on, you know, people who are helping you, your trainers, your coaches, and others around you. The perseverance to not give up when things get hard, the empathy and care for others. There are so many valuable life lessons that I don't actually think I truly appreciated until I took a step back and focused more on the education world and giving back to others.
You do describe that in your essay for The Next Idea, that you did through college kind of take that step back and then came to Detroit doing Teach for America. And then after that, you founded Detroit Horsepower. So why did you decide I need to step away from the classroom and pour my efforts into Detroit Horsepower?
Yeah, there were multiple factors there. First, after 2 years of teaching, I think I realized, you know, my skill set was not best suited to make an impact through the classroom, that there were other ways that I could use my skills and experiences to lift up others. In that space that I had, I was reflecting on the powerful ways horses have shaped who I am today. And I was learning more about the role of social, emotional factors, you know, confidence, responsibility, compassion, perseverance, and more that shapes academic and career success. So realizing that horses have developed a lot of those same characteristics in myself, and that horses are not accessible for kids in the city, became a really compelling motivation to step outside the classroom and try and wrap our kids in more layers of support that can contribute to their long-term success.
And you've launched this, and you've got Detroit Horsepower Incorporated as a 501c3, so this is coming together. And what is the structure now, David? Is it summer camps?
That's right. So we offer day camps. We recruit students through community partnerships, so schools and nonprofits in the city that identify students who would benefit the most from this unique kind of enrichment. And we bring them out for week-long programs, Monday to Friday. We teach riding. We teach horse care. We bring guest speakers to talk about different equine professions. And like we said earlier, you know, the goal is to broaden our kids' horizons for what's possible when they dedicate themselves to something they're passionate about, and to promote that kind of personal growth that will stay with kids for the rest of their lives. Ultimately, you know, this is our pilot stage, bringing kids from the city to partnering horse barns outside Detroit. And we're so grateful for those host facilities who have generously made their space and their horses available to us. But we do see our biggest impact in locating a new urban riding center in the city of Detroit and combining this powerful youth development opportunity with large-scale vacant land transformation.
Let's talk about this really big goal that you have. You looked around and you see vacant land in Detroit. You have kids in Detroit that you want to get on those horses, but right now you're having to take them outside of the city. Talk about this center you hope to have happen in Detroit.
It's certainly an ambitious goal, but I think there's the consensus building around the role of alternative kinds of development to support Detroit's neighborhoods, which are still struggling with so many factors, vacant land being one of them. So we are looking for the right fit of available open space, ideally 15 to 20 acres that does not have contaminated soil, and that's located in a community that wants horses to be part of the neighborhood's future, because obviously this won't work if residents don't want horses in their neighborhood. We have identified about 6 sites that we're highly interested in and are working with city government as they are moving closer to passing a new urban livestock ordinance that will give us the legal pathways to be approved and contribute to a stronger future for Detroit.
I like the way in your essay, David, you spent some time talking about the barriers of privilege that traditionally have pretty much limited access to horses to society's wealthiest people. And this is something you want to change.
Absolutely. I think growing up in affluent, mostly white suburb of New York City and having equestrian experiences that were even more skewed to a narrow band of society, I think there's a real challenge of equity and inclusion. We talked about the amazing benefits that horses can offer, but those are reserved to the most elite in our society, especially at a high level. You know, horses are expensive animals and take a lot of time and care, but finding ways to build a unique riding center in the city with a social enterprise model that brings in earned revenue to reduce our dependence on philanthropy can create a really unique situation that brings together people from very different backgrounds, more affluent equestrian folks and longtime Detroiters who are just learning about horses, and bringing them together in a shared space around a common passion for these incredible animals.
Well, you've mentioned one step to making this reality, and that's to get City Hall to support changes in the, or, you know, the livestock ordinance and pass this new urban livestock ordinance. So that would open the door legally to keeping horses and working with the communities to identify who wants us. What about the money?
We are preparing for a capital campaign that will draw from private donors, the wonderful foundations that support our city, and corporate philanthropy as well. You know, we are a relatively new organization, and these pilot programs are really important to build a track record of demonstrated interest and impact. So the 18 kids we worked with in 2015 and now the 80 kids that are going through our programs this summer, 2016, are huge steps along that path to building a broad coalition that's passionate about seeing horses contribute to Detroit's future.
What story of these youngsters that you're working with through Detroit Horsepower, is there a story that to you just really symbolizes or exemplifies what it is you're hoping to do with this group?
When we're in camp sessions, our kids always love the riding, and that was always really important to me when I was growing up. But I think some of our most powerful moments come in sort of the more relaxed moments, or what we call unmounted skills, activities that we're working on with horses when we're not riding. And the story that comes to mind is a girl in actually one of our very first program last year who was working on hand walking. So we have this really large 1,000-pound animal and a girl who's 11 years old and not very tall, trying to control and have the horse start walking when she wants him to start, stop when she wants him to stop and turn, etc. And she was struggling and working with myself and one of our other volunteers. in that light bulb moment when she got the horse to stop, when she wanted, walk on, turn, and stop again, she had the biggest smile on her face. And I was overcome as well. I was so excited for, you know, this huge progress she was making. And the words that came out of my mouth were, "Did you know you were that strong?" And she kind of paused and she thought for a second and she said, "No, I didn't know I was that strong." And I remember that because that really became a theme for that week. And obviously we're not really talking about physical strength. We're talking about strength of spirit and strength of conviction. And those are powerful lessons and growth that our kids carry with them well beyond the camps we're doing at this point.
You can learn more about David Silver's work by going to the website, DetroitHorsepower.org. There are some great photos. You've got to click on the photos and see the faces of these youngsters as they're riding and caring for the horses. You can also follow Detroit Horsepower on Facebook. And David's essay can be found on the Next Idea page at MichiganRadio.org. David Silver, thank you so much for sharing your vision with us on the Next Idea.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate this.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Healthy Michigan Plan launched in April 2014. It opened Medicaid rolls to hundreds of thousands of low-income people for the very first time, and no one was really quite sure what to expect. There were widely held fears that the flood of previously uninsured people would mean it would be tougher for everybody to get doctor's appointments, or that hospitals would be overloaded with seriously sick patients who, until then, didn't have insurance coverage. Well, here we are 2 years down the road, and there's enough data for experts to study and analyze. Let's see what really happened after expanding Medicaid under Healthy Michigan as we welcome Marianne Udall Phillips, director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Welcome.
Great to be here.
First, the public response to the Affordable Care Act and Healthy Michigan Medicaid expansion. More than 600,000 people signed up. That's 57% of the previously uninsured population. Did that outstrip expectations?
Oh, yes. You know, certainly in the time span that we're looking at here, that amount of people that enrolled was something we were projecting wouldn't happen for 5 years. So it was almost instantaneous in the state and really exciting for people to see how many people actually got enrolled. We did a great job as a state getting people into the program.
And then we know another 340,000 people bought private insurance through the state through the exchange. How did that fit with expectations?
That also exceeded our expectations. All of the projections that had been made for Michigan showed lower numbers of people enrolling in the health insurance exchange. So just generally, Michigan has done really well in getting people enrolled. And as a result, we've seen a very big drop in the number of people who are uninsured.
Well, then let's talk about those early fears before it all began, that doctors' offices and hospitals would be flooded with newly insured people and it would be hard to get an appointment. What actually happened?
We have not seen patients having difficulty getting appointments for primary care physicians or even specialists. In fact, we had done some projections. We did surveys before the Affordable Care Act went into effect and before the Medicaid expansion that said actually 80% of primary care physicians in our state were prepared to take new patients. And we've seen that is exactly what has happened. Most of them are taking Medicaid patients. They have room in their practices, and patients are not having difficulty getting primary care appointments.
We see Medicaid patients finding it easier than anyone thought it would be to get appointments in that 12-month period. I did see one statistic for people who had private insurance. They saw things shrink a little bit, 86% of clinics accepting new patients compared to 88% before the Medicaid expansion. Why did that tighten a little?
Well, it's just a change in the numbers of physicians that are available. We do have some physicians that are retiring. We have some that are changing their focus a little bit, but it's not a statistically significant change. Mm-hmm. It's pretty constant in terms of people of primary care, and 86% still very high rates of people being able to get primary care access.
What about the impact on admissions in hospitals in Michigan?
Well, we've seen, of course, a big change in who finances those admissions. We've seen a very significant drop in the percentage of people who are uninsured in our state. We've seen hospitals having more patients who have Medicaid enrollment, a 23% drop in uninsured bad debt charity care cases. So hospitals are doing quite well financially. And we've seen some increase in the care being provided because a number of the people who are getting insured did have some backlog of needs that are now being taken care of.
they're getting the care they need, but it was not a flood of people that crowded people out.
That's right. That's right. We still see, again, access to care in hospitals.
I want to break down just at the grassroots level to see what Healthy Michigan and the Medicaid expansion has meant for different groups of medical consumers. Let's start with low-income Michiganders.
Low-income Michiganders, again, many more people, as you said, more than 600,000 people who got added to the Medicaid rolls. We have about 1.7 million in traditional Medicaid. So that's a big growth in the Medicaid total population. We have almost a quarter of our state's population now enrolled in Medicaid. And for these people, many of them who were not eligible for any health insurance before, many of whom were uninsured, again, they're getting care that they've needed for a long time. And it's actually saved people's lives.
And then for someone who's had employer-provided health insurance, especially people that had it for a long time, how have they been affected?
Well, they haven't so much been affected by the Affordable Care Act. Many people under employer-sponsored health insurance have gotten somewhat broader coverage because the Affordable Care Act requires coverage of certain preventive services with no cost sharing. But we have seen a lot of changes for people who have employer-sponsored coverage. About half our state's population has employer-sponsored coverage. And for the most part, what they are seeing are higher deductibles and higher co-payments. That's been a trend that's been going on for a long time, predated the Affordable Care Act, but is certainly very prevalent now as almost a quarter of people with employer coverage have what's known as a high deductible health plan.
So we're shifting costs.
So we're shifting costs to consumers. And in fact, when you actually look at what's happened since the Affordable Care Act, we now have more people who we would consider to be underinsured than people who are uninsured. So we've done a great job in getting people coverage, but many of the people who have coverage have very high deductibles and copays, and they have difficulty affording care because of those copays and deductibles.
Is that because people who didn't buy on the exchange knowing what they were buying, or is it because of this shift in the employer-sponsored care?
It was predominantly because of the shift in the employer-sponsored care, because so many more people get coverage through employers. Only about 300 and so thousand people in our state get coverage through the exchange, but even they typically are buying plans with higher deductibles and copays. A lot of them, 80% or so of them, get some support for cost sharing to get those deductibles and copays lower. So it's more about what's happening in the employer market. And that has more to do with employers still trying to manage healthcare costs and shifting more of those costs to consumers.
Would we say there are any losers in all of this?
I wouldn't describe anyone as a loser in this. You know, this is something where we've really expanded care without significantly expanding costs. We continue to see healthcare cost trends that are moderate, in fact, lower than they were before the Affordable Care Act. We see many more people getting the care that they need. We haven't completely reformed the system yet. And this issue of the underinsured and people losing coverage is still a very significant problem. So we haven't solved all the problems, but I don't think we've seen really losers in the system as a result of these changes.
Now, I have seen reports over the year that not enough healthy young people were signing up on the exchanges. This was nationally, not specific to Michigan. Where are we with that?
We have seen a significant percentage of young, healthy people who have gotten enrolled. But if you're a health insurer, you want those young, healthy people. But actually, what you really want are people who have some chronic disease that can be better managed, because there are incentives in the way that funding works for you to take patients who are somewhat higher risk, but where you can actually improve the cost and the use of services and care. So we are doing a better job of getting people with some chronic disease in.
Sure, sure. Now, keeping an eye on what will be happening in November as the nation chooses a new president, what could the outcome of that election mean for the future of the ACA? And by that, I mean you've got people whose lives have been made better because they now have coverage where they didn't before, or you have people who do not like what has happened to their coverage because of the ACA, either in terms of having to pay for stuff they don't want or not being able to go to a doctor they want to see. So you've got both groups eyeing this and wondering what, if anything, could a new president do to the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it's going to be really very fascinating to see what happens. Yeah. Of course, it so much depends on who gets elected. If we see Hillary Clinton elected, I think you'll see sort of a continuation of where we are now, depending on what happens in Congress. Actually, there's some people that are expecting that after this election, if Hillary Clinton wins, almost regardless of what happens in Congress, we might begin to see some movement on fixing some of the pieces that have been stalled on the Affordable Care Act. There's actually more bipartisan support to fix some of the components of the Affordable Care Act and live within this framework. And we're seeing some language around that out there in the political world. Now, if Donald Trump were elected president, I think we don't really know what would happen. He's not been particularly clear about what he would do with a health plan. He says he's opposed to the Affordable Care Act, but His alternative has not been made very clear. We do have a proposal from Paul Ryan just recently on behalf of the Republicans that would repeal many parts of the Affordable Care Act, still leave some of the framework in place, but repeal the Medicaid structure as it is, fundamentally change Medicare to more of a what's called a defined contribution, where you get a fixed amount of money and you have to buy coverage yourself. That would be a huge change in the way Medicare is delivered, and the individual mandate would go away under the Paul Ryan approach. So the Republicans still are proposing things that would radically change the Affordable Care Act and could, we think, cause many people who've had coverage lose that coverage in the future.
Marianne Udall Phillips, Director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan Health System. Great to have you with us as always.
And great to be here. Thanks, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
It's over easy, a plate of hash browns. Take my hand, mama, we're going to town. Oh, what a wonderful thing to do. Eggs over easy, hash browns and you.
That song, Angelo's, by Dick Siegel, is the signal to legions of loyal listeners. It's time for Sunday Morning Over Easy. The program's been a longtime favorite on Detroit radio station WCSX. Producer-host Pam Rossi brings local, national, international musicians into the studio to perform and to talk. Now she's sharing years of great conversations with great musicians in her book, Conversations with Pam Rossi. Pam, good to see you here on Stateside.
Good to see you. Thank you.
175 musicians in this book, and I'm betting that you just scratched the surface of all the people that you've talked to in the 17 years you've been doing Sunday Morning Easy.
Yeah,
any
absolutely.
Idea how many musicians you've had come in over the years?
More than that, than this 175. But, you know, many times I forgot to record or something, and, you know, I literally could go back and count, but I'm not going to do that because it's quite a few.
Probably scary when you think about that. What is your mission for Sunday Morning Over Easy? What do you want to give listeners?
Well, I want to get a feel for, you know, the good music. First of all, it's all about the music. That's the main thing. You know, enjoy the music. Bring in your Sunday morning slower than normal. You know, just ease into it, even though it's the last day of the weekend. And, you know, and share some good music with people. And with the conversations, of course, let the musicians tell their story.
And they get to come in and do it in a very relaxed and long form. It's not just a little quick interview somewhere.
Oh, no. No, no.
And how do you find they receive that?
Well, what happens is, and you'll notice through the conversations, it becomes a conversation, not an interview. And many times, and I say in my introduction, it felt like I was sitting there just talking to a friend. And that's what I wanted it to be. You know, sometimes I didn't even realize that, but it was like, yeah, all of a sudden it was just the two of us talking or three, whatever. And it was a conversation.
For people that might not be within the market area to be familiar with the program and with what's on WCSX every Sunday morning, what's the format? And just kind of give people an idea of what people hear.
Sure. Well, it is a classic rock station, so I still play that genre, but I dig deeper and softer. So we're still playing, you know, you'll hear a lot of the singer-songwriters. James Taylor, Dan Fogelberg, Carole King. So a lot more of that is mixed in than your typical classic rock station. So that's part of the music. It's a little laid back singer-songwriter style.
And how did the book come about then?
Oh, well, many listeners over the years kept saying, oh, I love so-and-so interview, or I loved listening to such-and-such person talk about, you know, their music and everything. And so, you know, the wheels started turning a little bit. I thought, you know what? These people want to hear these again, you know, how can we hear these again? And I thought, well, let's put it in a book. It just kind of spurred from a listener talking to me about wanting to hear it again.
And as I look at the book, and go through, it's a ponderous book because you've got all of these folks. And I thought that the interesting breakdown, there's rockers, finger stylists, singer-songwriters, folk slash Americana, blues, and then genre? What genre? Give us a sense of some of the people in this book.
Well, rockers, of course, easy because it was a classic rock station. So a lot of these, the reason I would have them is they went solo or they had, you know, a tour coming up, usually a new CD. And a lot of times it was their solo things that got these rockers in here, not the full band, like, you know, not Triumph, but Rick Emmett, who's went solo. And so he was promoting that. So that's what a lot of the rockers are.
Blues, you've got Laith Elsaadi, mm-hmm. So who's just been on this program recently, just after getting on
The Voice.
The Voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then genre, what genre? And I love seeing the fact you had the Chenille sister. sisters there, because if you cannot pigeonhole the Chenil sisters.
No. And most of those you can't. There's only a few in that group, but it's like, well, they kind of fit here, they kind of fit there, but they really don't fit there, so they put that.
Now, as we kind of alluded to, you have a real array of musicians. You've got the Michigan stalwarts like, you know, Liz Lahren and the Chenil sisters and, you know, John D. Lamb. So you've got people known in Michigan. And then you've got names like Roger McGuinn and Dave Mason and Dennis DeYoung and Richie Havens and Peter Yarrow. And I'm kind of interested, as you approach these conversations, what are you looking to get out of them?
Well, I always look for that gem that no one heard before. If I can get something from them that they never said it over the microphone before or dug really deep, that was my goal. And just through the conversation and listening to them, sometimes I could go a different direction because of something they said and find those gems.
And as you mentioned, you're giving a platform to especially some of these newer artists, whether they're local, whether they're national, but because it's harder today than it was, for example, Roger McGuinn in the 60s when anything went on radio.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's with the way the programs are now, it's so, you know, cut, you know, and so many, you can only talk so many seconds, you know, it's really tough. So when I was able to get these people on, they really appreciated it because it's so hard to get out there anymore.
Recent interview that Roger Daltrey of The Who gave to Rolling Stone where he just said, you know, there's no more record industry anymore. Why would I make a record? And he said the way the internet has come about, it's been the biggest robbery in history. Are you hearing a disenchantment from people or is it generational? Are the younger ones more optimistic?
Yes. Basically, you can't do records anymore. It doesn't pay. The touring is what they have to do. You can definitely see the generational gap there. The old timers, this is how we used to do it. This is the way business was done to get our music out there. You've got to do the albums. You know, of course, the artwork and the albums and the liner notes, it was all part of the package. Well, not anymore. Obviously, all that's gone. Although you're seeing some people going back to the vinyl, which is really cool because they realize, well, this is like almost like a collection, you know, and a lot of them are doing the vinyl so they can sell because people are collecting vinyl now.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And as much as Daltrey was complaining about the internet and saying it's robbing musicians, it's also a place for an up and coming hopeful to get out there for free.
Oh, yes. It's amazing how many are doing it on their own and just doing it through the internet and doing well.
As you look at this whole list of these 175 names, what jumps out? Any ones where you want to say to people listening to us, oh, read the interview with?
There are several in there, of course. Kathy McDonald is one. She is in the Rockers. And the name is not someone you would recognize, but she was the backup singer for the Stones, for Joe Cocker, for Leon Russell. And she had some great stories. We got talking. And again, it was just like her and I, and we were just laughing. And I was so intently listening to her just because these stories were so good that I completely blew a stop set, you know, no commercials. And like, and all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, you know, but she was a lot of fun. She has passed away since then, which so I'm really glad I got her in the book. Jeff Daniels, of course, local guy. If you ever see him or just know him, I mean, he's so fun to talk to.
He is.
It was so fun when he came in, you know, and I had to go out to the door and I'm walking back and he's like, I need paper and pencil. Got a paper and pencil. It's like, okay. So as soon as I get in the studio, I give him this paper and he's just writing because we weren't ready to go on the air yet. And he added a whole verse to his Tiger song because the night before they had lost right then and there. And then he performed it live. It was like, wow.
Wow.
That's talent, you know. I'm sure he was thinking about it all the way to the studio, but it was crazy. I just watched him write a whole nother verse to this fabulous song already and then performed it live. But the main thing about a lot of these was how funny they all were. The humor with these songwriters, probably because they're all creatives and it just flowed. It was amazing.
Where can people find your book?
You can get it at Amazon or my website is probably one of the better places, pamrossi.com.
Well, a lot of fun to read this, a lot of fun listening on Sunday mornings to Sunday Morning Over Easy. The book is Conversations with Pam Rossi, and that's R-O-S-S-I. Pam, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scott. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. michiganbusiness.org.